Station break about the medical evidence conflicting with the conclusions reached by the ballistics experts for the FBI. So let's pick that up again.
Yeah, well, in the commission hearings, which, again, you get at the Monterey Peninsula Library or from your Carmel Library or ask Monterey to order them, the 26 volumes of commission hearings where various people were called to testify about evidence of medical examinations and practical problems of criminology of who was committing these murders of Oswald or of John Kennedy. Dr. Shaw, in Volume 6, page 113, said he can't place where the wrist of Governor Connally would be at the time his chest was struck. Now, in Volume 4, on page 120 to 128, there's a Dr. Gregory, who also performed surgery on Governor Connally. He had surgery on the wrist, the leg, the chest, and Dr. Gregory performed surgery on his chest. And he was confused by the Warren Commission statements. And this is his statement. The only way the missile could have produced this wound, in my view, was to have entered the wrist backwards. The wounds he saw were not at all characteristic of an entry wound of a pristine missile, which tends to make a small wound of entrance and a larger wound of exit. And I would like to add that we were disconcerted by not finding a missile at all. Here was our patient with three discernible wounds and no missile within him of sufficient magnitude to account for them, and we suggested that someone ought to search his belongings in other areas. Now, later they went out in a hall and found a full bullet on a stretcher that was supposed to come from John Connally, but they never could confirm the fact that he was on that stretcher. And this is documented. It was just a stretcher, and they're not sure who was even on that stretcher. And there are missiles still in him, particles in him, and Dr. Frazier was concerned about the variance of the different. He suggested it could be two different weapons. Now, his belongings at this time that the doctor said they should search his belongings now were in a paper bag with Mr. Carter when they were doing that surgery, the belongings that he refers to that would have been useful. And Dr. Shaw was performing the surgery on John Connally, and Connally's clothing were sitting in a room with Lyndon Johnson in two paper bags. Now, Dr. Shaw and Dr. Gregory gave the commission a hard time, and they wouldn't come to a conclusion of entry or exit wounds on the governor's wrist. And while the former wanted to make all the wounds from a single bullet, the Warren Commission, the ballistics, the x-rays didn't fit together. So it finally, in desperation, Dr. Shaw came to one conclusion. To Arlene Specter, he says, we'll get the suit of his. It'll help a lot. Can we get his suit? And Mr. Specter's answer was, well, we are going to examine the clothing if it's possible. Well, why wouldn't they have examined? You see, this hearing before the commission was in March or April when the doctors were called to testify. And I'm sure that they believed that the evidence hadn't been tampered with or altered. All you had to do is get the clothing and prove whether the doctors were right or the commission was right.
They hadn't tried at that point?
Oh, no. Oh, no. The clothing was, you know, thrown off to Washington, the day of the murder of John Kennedy. And these men were giving their medical opinion based upon x-rays and surgical records of what happened to John Connally. You see, the x-rays of John Kennedy were locked up. They weren't even developed to solve the crime. The commission didn't even see them. But the doctors from John Connally are saying to Arlene Specter and the commission, it couldn't be the way you said it happened because they're trying to reword their medical findings that didn't fit what the commission wanted to say. So finally, Dr. Shaw says, we'll get the clothing. And then Arlene Specter says, well, if it's possible, we will. Well, how can you find out who did the murder without going through the actual physical evidence? So what happened all the way down the line? So the surgeons were asking for the garments, but the commission wasn't sure they could get them. But when they got them, the clothing had been dry cleaned and pressed. And they could never find out. Nobody has ever found out what happened to the clothing. See, whether there was an entry hole in the governor's sleeve and so forth, or who sent it to the clinger. They never found out who sent the garment to the clinger, which dry clinger in Washington cleaned it and pressed it. Were these things delivered to the clinger, or did he pick them up? Were they left off by some particular person? Who paid the bill for the dry clinging? You know, you'd have a record of some of this stuff. These are things. I did this for an article to send in to a magazine on the clothing of John Connally. You break the Warren Commission down, it's like taking the hangnail of a body that, you know, when your finger gets abscessed and your whole system, your hand is throbbing, you know, the feeling your arm is hurting and you have a sore. You just break down many of the pieces of evidence in this murder, and you could do chapters of books endlessly. And I did this for a chapter and article. Wanting to know, well, who paid? Go to the dry cleaning place and find out who paid for it to be cleaned. And did Congressman Gonzalez pay for it? Was the bill sent to Mrs. Conley? Where are the clothing? So I looked up the testimony on Congressman Gonzalez. He was in the motorcade. He was at Parkland Hospital. He's the man who took the clothing. So you want to find out, how did he end up with the clothing? So I looked in Volume 15 under Gonzalez. He was never called as a witness to testify before the Warren Commission. He ends up with the clothing of John Conley, but he's never called as a witness. So I looked up every reference to Mr. Congressman Gonzalez. He was mentioned in Volume 6, Volume 7, and Volume 15. In Volume 6, the nurse, the head nurse, Miss Stanbridge, gives testimony that she gave the clothing to Clifton Carter, who signed for it. And it was found in Representative Gonzalez's closet, but it was an indirect reference to Gonzalez. That Miss Stanbridge just said, Clifton Carter, this is Lyndon Johnson's aide and pal, and was sitting in the emergency room, Parkland Hospital, got the clothing. In Volume 7, Mr. Carter is called for a deposition. He was not a witness before the Warren Commission. And he made a deposition that Congressman Gonzalez sat in the room with him at Parkland Hospital. They said, who sat with you in that room? And he mentioned the people in the room. He makes no mention of signing for a paper bag or turning it over to anybody. He's not called as a witness. He simply fills out a piece of paper. The nurse has testified that she handed it to Clifton Carter. When he makes a deposition, he doesn't even mention receiving clothing of any kind. He just mentions he sat in a room. That's his deposition. In Volume 15, a newspaper man mentions that he saw Congressman Gonzalez at Parkland Hospital. Those are the only three mentions of him out of 26 million words, 26 volumes, each 1,000 pages. There's no reference to the clothing at all, even when these people are interviewed.
So there's question as to who accepted the clothing and where it went after it left Parkland Hospital.
That's right. You see, the nurse simply turned it into a room where Lyndon Johnson was sitting, the clothing of Governor Conley. And then Clifton Carter, who received the bag, never is called as a witness, and no mention of Gonzalez as a witness before the Warren Commission at all. Now, they were in the motorcade. Gonzalez was in the motorcade. He sat with the president at Parkland Hospital. He returned to the Washington that same evening with the clothing of Governor Conley. And they never asked him who gave him the clothing, why Carter signed for it, why he handed it over to Gonzalez, how the clothing were found, you know, by the dry cleaner, who signed for them. Did he have household help who sent them out, who laundered them, why the FBI didn't have them, why the Secret Service didn't have them. You see, I'm dwelling in detail on this particular item today because last week we did Bullet 399, and in a continuous pattern for people who are taping the shows or listening every week and talking about destruction of evidence, I'm taking one thing to tie in with the current destruction of that memo and trying to show that what happened with John Conley's clothing that would help tell where the gunman stood in the John Kennedy murder. So then I wanted to find out about Clifton Carter. I looked up the testimony on Gonzalez. There was nothing, and I want to look up Clifton Carter. So I look in Volume 15 of the commission hearings. There's an index of every witness that's called before the commissioner, an affidavit. And Clifton Carter was never called as a witness like Mr. Gonzalez. He was in the motorcade. He was at the hospital. He was never questioned. He went back with President Johnson to the White House. He slept at the White House that night. He's never called as a witness on why he received that clothing. He described the motorcade. He sent a letter to the Warren Commission called an affidavit, dated May the 20th, 1964. And he describes the motorcade, the shots, waiting at Parkland Hospital, boarding the plane, and he describes how he helped plan President Kennedy's trip to Texas, June the 5th, 1963. In El Paso, Texas, at the Cortez Hotel, June the 5th, 1963, Clifton Carter and Lyndon Johnson and two other gentlemen had a meeting, and that date they determined that John Kennedy would come to Dallas in the fall. They decided. And he's back. John Kennedy is dead. The occupant of the White House is out. Clifton Carter is sleeping with Lyndon Johnson, keeping him company the evening of the assassination. The clothing has been transferred. He signed for it. The evidence of the direction of the bullets, the amount of bullets, or helping decide how many bullets came, has been handed. This piece of evidence has been handed to Clifton Carter, given it to Gonzalez. He's not called as a witness. He isn't even asked to testify. Now, his name is only mentioned five times, Clifton Carter. Once, where he describes the motorcade. The second time is where Agent Youngblood, that's the Secret Service agent, that was with President Johnson, Vice President Johnson. He testified that Clifton Carter was in the follow-up car behind Vice President Johnson. Agent Youngblood is the man who jumped on top of Lyndon Johnson to protect him when the shots fired, and there were several pillows in Lyndon Johnson's car. Nobody knows why, but he was protected with pillows, and he didn't have a back problem or anything, but Youngblood was the man. He just mentioned Clifton Carter once. In Volume 5, Henry Wade mentioned Carter's name, only in reference because they got a call from Washington, from Clifton Carter, "Have you found that person yet?" Henry Wade is a district attorney of Dallas. And he called me and he said, "Are they making any progress in the case?" Henry Wade, Volume 5, page 251, says, "You see, Cliff Carter and I are close personal friends." Now, Henry Wade is the district attorney of Dallas who's going to close that case at a press conference Friday night. We have the lone assassin. It's Lee Harvey Oswald. And Clifton Carter, at that point that Henry Wade has a press conference in Dallas, Clifton Carter is with Lyndon Johnson in Washington, holding the clothing that would tell whether bullets came from the front or not. Volume 5, page 561, President Johnson mentions that Clifton Carter entered the surgical room at Parkland Hospital. Those are the only references to his name. And in Volume 6, page 111, Miss Stambridge, the nurse that we mentioned before, who mentions Mr. Gonzalez, said she went to the room where Vice President Johnson and his party were sitting. They opened the door and they asked for somebody. And he said he identified himself as Clifton Carter. They opened the door, and they asked for somebody. And he identified himself as Clifton Carter. And she was told this was Governor Connally's party sitting in that room. And Mrs. Connally, the only member of Governor Connally's party, really, was in the hall. His wife, I don't know what kind of a party Governor Connally is having, but Lyndon Johnson and Gonzalez and Clifton Carter are sitting, and the Judge Thornburg, you know, Lyndon Johnson's newly appointed judge in Texas, are sitting in this outside room. Now, it's interesting, Texas was going to investigate this particular crime. I wonder if that judge would have been the judge on the case. Clifton Carter received the clothing. Now, in the following this evidence that was destroyed, to recapitulate, Phil, I went into the research, and this took 8-9 years of nitpicking to go through all of this stuff. You know, I've done this on so many aspects of the case. You go into what the doctor's testimony of why the clothing is important, the impossibility of what the Warren Commission happened. You go into who received the clothing, what happened to it, do they ever investigate it? The Warren Commission doesn't ask Congressman Gonzalez about his having that evidence destroyed. It doesn't ask what the nature of Governor Connally's party was that was taking place, or Clifton Carter, why he signed for it instead of the investigative agencies, the policemen signing for the garments, or Mrs. Connally. It certainly doesn't belong to Lyndon Johnson, the clothing, why it was brought into that room. And this is what I call the chain of possession on evidence destroyed. You see, this is one sample of the kind of research I do. You know, I've got a lot of it. That is the destruction of the evidence of the car, of the clothing. We've gone into the car interior and the street sign. Now, the crucial frames of the Zapruder film that are mentioned over and over again, many of those were lost, and Life magazine bought that immediately after the assassination, and they signed an affidavit saying they were spliced out. They didn't explain, but it's in the commission hearings that they were spliced out by their own admission. Now, there were notes taken in the Dallas jail, and this has been verified. From the time Oswald was arrested, the Dallas police had no tape recorder or device to keep track of what Oswald was saying in this Dallas jail for 48 hours before he was killed. But all those notes were thrown away. The Dallas policemen had no records. There is record that they took notes because Captain Fritz of Hopenside would say, we took notes of this or notes of that. But after Oswald was dead, there were no notes taken.
Let's explain the significance of that. First, with the frames of these Zapruder films, which were spliced out and will never be seen, presumably, by anybody. What is the significance of not having those?
Well, because many people on the peninsula were fortunate enough to see a rerun of the Zapruder movie that we had out at Monterey Peninsula College. And for those of you who haven't, you can see single frames of him photographed in Life magazine or in the commission hearings. The significance was that the bullet direction seemed to show, based on the law of physics, that John Kennedy's head was thrown backwards when he was hit the fatal bullet, which means that the direction of the gunman was to the right of him and somewhat to the front, and not from behind on the sixth floor. When the Warren Commission printed the frames by frame of the killing of John Kennedy, they renumbered them and later admitted when the book came out that they had his head going forward frame by frame, admitted they put them in the wrong error. So the Warren Commission hearings in the volumes have photographs of John Kennedy's head, each frame going forward a little bit more. And then,
so they reversed it to make it appear differently.
Yeah, and then they admitted that they had printed them in reversal. They numbered them, but they printed them not in the right number. The numbers are there, but it's printed in a reversal thing.
So it gives you, in looking at it, it gives you the opposite impression.
That's right. If you flick it, it looks like his head's going forward, and actually it was going backwards. So they printed them with a reversal, and the important thing about deleting these particular films, that they were spliced out when you have a movie. One reason that it's important to find out what happened is I have a whole document that another woman was hit and fell down. She was behind the car over opposite the grassy knoll at the curb facing the book depository across the street from the depository. And in some frames, there's a frame where this woman is standing on the curb and there's another one where she's down on the grass. And there's, it was a color movie, and I have the documents of research where they reconstructed the pictures, even of the Zapruder thing. If you look carefully, it looks like there's blood that she's been hit. And so
they ever found that woman?
No, no. They've never located her, but you see her standing on the curb, then you see her down on the ground, and it looks like she's been hurt. There were several people that fell to the ground, and if you, oh, you missed the movies that night, you were out of town, where he shows immediately after John Kennedy's car went down the street and went on to Parkland Hospital, about 12 feet from where the fatal bullet would have hit him as the car went around that particular curb, it shows a Secret Service man, an FBI man, lean down on the grass and pick up an object and put it in their pocket. You know, like, and the only assumption is it's a shell. They were identified as members of the Bureau, see, and they put something in their pocket. So to delete it, you may show somebody else that was hit in the confusion of that moment. She could have been taken off for hospital care and just, you know, no one has ever seen her.
So there was the significance of the deletion of the part of the Zapruder films. Now, you mentioned that the notes taken about Oswald and his behavior, what he was doing during those 48 hours that he was in the Dallas jail and alive,
those notes
were destroyed. Now,
completely destroyed.
Now, if those notes were available, what would they say?
Well, let's give you an inkling of what they would say. When Oswald was taken to a press conference, they had a meeting that Henry Wade called late Friday night, you know, in the basement of the jail, where Jack Ruby described himself as the entrepreneur of the Dallas jail. He was the master of ceremonies for the news media down there that night. Walking from the corridors to the room and back to his room, and in the halls were newspeople men, and they picked up this kind of thing. They heard him say, "I'm only a patsy." They heard him say, "I didn't kill anybody." They heard him yell out, if they asked him about a rifle with a picture of his head on a body, and the body was holding the rifle and the pistol and the militant, you know, communist literature. He said, "That's not my head. The picture's been superimposed." He had an interview with his brother, and the brother said, "Looks like you're in trouble, Lee." And Lee said, "Don't believe all that evidence." He said, "I didn't kill anyone. I didn't own a rifle. I'm a patsy." These are various things that he was saying. So you can imagine what went on in the Dallas jail for 48 hours before he was killed.
Of course, those are some of the things that you would expect a man to say that's, you know, been apprehended for the murder of a president, to not admit that he did it.
Well, that's all right. You could say that those are the normal things for him to say, but if you're going to destroy the evidence that would prove his innocence or guilt, it gets back to what Mr. Tunney said again about the ITT memo. The very fact that you destroy things, let's read what John Tunney said this week. Under common law, when a person destroys evidence, they say it is a presumption of guilt. If the Dallas police and the FBI and the CIA are destroying the evidence of Lee Harvey Oswald's associations or contacts, you have to ask why, because so much evidence was destroyed. If it was just one thing, if just the police records were destroyed and everything else were intact, you'd have a clear-cut case against Oswald. You see, there's a law in the post office that 2 years from the day you fill out an application for your P.O. box, they save that slip. And when and you sign the name of who receives mail at your box. You have a P.O. box in Carmel. And you have permission for you and your wife to receive your mail, right? And if somebody else receives it, their name is on that slip. So if you receive a package under the name of Heidel to your box, such as a rifle, and somebody has to have permission to receive that package. You see, and the post, when they call Postmaster Holmes about the application of slip, could a rifle come under the name Heidel, the post office application was destroyed. Now, it's a federal law that has to be kept for 2 years, so somebody should be prosecuted. See, we're talking now, I've only brought in a list of 11 pieces of evidence because there isn't any more time. We could go into about 30 more things. You know, we could continue this next week. But the post office slip was destroyed. Now, Oswald had a passport. In volume 23, page 188, they had a passport that he had applied for. And they had Exhibit C was one time accompanied by a document marked secret. And the Warren Commission wanted to know what was on this passport that was marked secret. So the document was accompanied with a message from the CIA, and Exhibit C indicates that the copy in Oswald's passport file was accidentally destroyed November the 23rd, 1963, while it was being thermofaxed. You like that one?
I mean, the day after the assassination.
The day after the assassination, his passport papers that had been marked secret were accidentally burned by thermofaxing. And this is at the passport office. Now, we have the name of a man in State Department who had Lee Harvey Oswald's papers on his desk the day of the assassination. November the 23rd, 1963, his passport papers that were marked secret were thermofaxed.
What were the papers doing on this person's desk that you mentioned the day of the assassination?
Well, Oswald was an agent of the CIA and the FBI, and they were pulling these papers out. I'm sure that some people dislike these memos of the ITT. You see, Jack Anderson comes out with certain charges of a deal that's being made to stop this huge corporation from gobbling up more billions of dollars of how do you describe the conglomerates that get together, you know, and join to push out all small companies that are trying to exist in the United States. And when Jack Anderson comes out with a memo on February the 23rd, the evidence in Dita Beard's office destroyed February 24th. Now, the same thing happens with Lee Harvey Oswald. You see, the news today isn't any different than then, but people weren't aware of it then, and a lot of people don't have access to this is why I'm on the air, to share my research of what's happening. Now, we know that the autopsy notes were burned when the Warren Commission came out with two autopsies. The FBI had one version, that one bullet went finger length and didn't go through, which would count for another hole in John Kennedy's body. The Navy Dr. Bethesda came out with an altogether different autopsy paper. And many people are familiar with the destruction of the autopsy paper by Dr. Hume. And this is why I spend so much time on the other things, because we know, or maybe a lot of people are not familiar with the fact, that they ended up with two autopsy reports that were different from each other, and the x-rays of the body hadn't been examined to prove which one was right or wrong, and they're locked up for your lifetime if you want it to be that way. But when they called Dr. Hume to testify, he said he burned them in his fireplace. Did he take them home with him? And he destroyed his original autopsy by burning. Maybe his original autopsy matched the FBI autopsy, which would mean then that Oswald was not the lone assassin, if he was the assassin at all. It meant there were more gunmen, because reconstructing the crime, you couldn't do that many shots in the time period allotted.
I'm talking about this evidence, May. You've mentioned that some of this is locked up for your lifetime if you want it that way. You've said that a couple of times.
Yeah.
Maybe you should reiterate again what you're saying.
Well,
you said it on other programs.
Oh, yeah. What I'm trying to say is that when the Warren Report was out, Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States at the time, announced that much of the evidence that the commission used would be locked up for the lifetime of every person living at that particular, it was 1964, 75 years this material would be locked up. And I say it'll be locked up if you want it. If you don't want it that way, you can begin writing to your congressman and putting pressure and letting them know, letting the candidates know what is happening, and that you're not completely stupid as to these murders. We got a letter last week, a listener and her husband who listened to the radio shows here wrote to McGovern. They took my suggestion, and they wrote to McGovern and said there is this particular person out on the peninsula who says there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, and she has the information, and would you open up the National Archives, and what is your position? And they mentioned Bud Fensterwald from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations. Let me read that letter that they got back. This is a letter asking McGovern, your candidate for President of the United States, what would he do? This is an election year. There's evidence of a conspiracy. Would he consider opening up this evidence and finding out who killed John Kennedy, and that there is this Mr. Fensterwald in Washington with the Committee to Investigate Assassinations? Now, here's the letter they received. Dear Mr. I'll leave the name off the air here. Thank you for your recent letter. It is good to know of your support as we prepare for the critical primary in Wisconsin on April the 4th. We have received a good deal of information from Mr. Fensterwald and his committee, and I am pleased to know of your interest in his activities. With every good wish, I am sincerely George McGovern. Now, these people mentioned that there is a committee to investigate assassinations headed by Bernard Fensterwald, the attorney for James Ray, to find out who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. What would he do, they asked, if he were elected president, to get the information to the people? And McGovern says, I have information from Fensterwald, and I'm pleased to know of your interest in his activity. Now, this couple on the Monterey Peninsula didn't want to write to George McGovern and tell them that they're interested in Fensterwald. They asked McGovern, would he open up the truth of who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King? And he skirts around that with absolutely no commitment. But the point is this. He knows that Bud Fensterwald exists, and he knows that the Committee to Investigate Assassinations is pressing for Congress to take a new investigation into the legislative body, into Congress, the executive. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon control the information now, and they control the power as the president and past president. And it's up to you to ask the Congress, like Richard Nixon isn't investigating the ITT case. He's involved in it. The Senate Judiciary is investigating it, not the executive branch. There's a difference. So if all of you would write, like this particular couple, write to George McGovern, write to anybody, and let them know you're not completely stupid, that this thing is growing out here and that you're aware and that you're absorbing facts and information, and let them know you're not stupid, maybe if they get enough letters like this, things will begin to change. You know, when I came in, you were excited about the decision of the Jackson, the Salt Dead trial of the boys up in San Francisco this week, Phil. And I can tell you that a handful of people on this peninsula, and I can name them on this show, and they really we could do a show about them, kept that thing going when the first shootout took place out on the grounds in Soledad. And we said that was a political thing. They were aiming for Jackson on the ground that day, George Jackson, and that was a political ambush to get those boys. Done by the personnel and the guards, no one would believe us. They thought we were loony. And a handful of people on this Monterey Peninsula have worked very, very hard, keeping the interest going, generating, getting the truth, digging this thing out till it became a national thing, and you begin to find truth where it really is. You see, and you can be proud of that case, and you can, just like the Soledad thing was reversed, the people listening to this show want the information that's locked up for 75 years. You will get that information if you keep pressing. People do have the power. I'm not as discouraged as you are about some of these things. I think they have the power to keep things moving.
I guess we should say, in wrapping things up, that if you want to write to a representative, or if you want to write to me about the program, that you can write care of the station, KLRB, Box 3904 in Carmel, or they can write directly to you if they want, I guess.
Yes, or Wednesday night, the Democratic candidates are going to be in the Carmel area, or whenever they pass through town. Interview them. Say, would you open up the Warren Commission hearings? We have evidence of a conspiracy. We know people who have. What are you going to do? Pressure the Democrats, the Republican, the Peace and Freedom, the states' rights. They're on record for opening up the Warren Commission.
Okay, that's Dialogue Assassination for this Saturday. Thanks for joining us.